Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It's been 7 months since St. Louis Public Radio merged with the St. Louis Beacon. How's that union going? We'll talk about it with the two managers at the top, Tim Eby and Margie Freivogel. But first, former Congressman Todd Akin. It's been almost 2 years since the six-term Missouri Republican congressman uttered the words that made him a household name. Those words, during an interview with Channel 2's Charles Jaco, included the phrase, legitimate rape, and referred to a woman's ability to shut down an unwanted pregnancy from such an assault. The comments came early in his campaign for the U.S. Senate against incumbent Democrat Claire McCaskill, cost him the support of many Republican leaders at home and around the country, and cost him the election. Congressman Akin has since written a response to all of this in his new book, Firing Back, Taking on Party Bosses and Media Elite to Protect Our Faith and Our Freedom. He has admitted that he misspoke, but also feels his comments were misinterpreted and taken out of context. He has pulled back his apology for the comments made more than a year ago. In the book, he defends them. Congressman Akin, nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to join you, Don.
You know, I think I know the answer to this question, but I'd like to get it from you in your own words. And that is, what was the need you felt to fire back?
Well, there were many aspects of the campaign that a lot of people didn't know. For being in the middle of it, making those decisions, other people didn't have a chance to see what was happening. And I love a good story, and I was approached by a publisher, and I thought, you know, it is, I hate to write about the one race we lost after having won for 24 years, but it was a compelling story, but there's a lot of stuff that people don't know. And then I've read in different and hear in different news publications things that are just don't square with the facts at all. So I thought, you know, whether people like it or not, I think truth is a good thing. And what I tried to do is to write Firing Back as a fast read. We cut 100 pages out of it, condensed it down, and tried to keep it just moving. A lot of short chapters and fun things like what was it like to be a congressman on September 11th and things like that. But I wanted to get the truth out, and I wanted to correct certain misconceptions and places where people were going because of our race that were just – they just didn't square with the facts. So it's mostly – get the truth out, try and tell a good story, and really the same thing that I tried to do for 24 years in public office, and that was, I think all of us would like to give back to the country that we love. I've got now coming up on 11 grandkids. We'd like to leave America a good place. And so I was trying to make a distinction between good ideas that make people free and prosperous and bad ideas that leave people in misery.
Are you ever going to be able to get away from those words with Jaco?
I don't know. Well, ask me that in 10 years, and we'll see.
Well, I hope we're both here that we can pose that.
That sounds good, Don. I'll agree to that.
Why did you agree to do that interview with him? You quoting the book, you called him a hard-bitten liberal trying to trap you into a soundbite his liberal allies could exploit.
Well, that's true. I had worked with Jaco 12 years as a congressman. We knew each other. I had gotten very strong advice from a good friend that did our media at the point we won the primary. He said, do not talk to any media. They will exploit what you said, say they're ruthless, they will intentionally misunderstand, and they'll destroy you with it. Do not talk to media. But because he'd been asking for 3 or 4 months and I knew him personally, I thought, and I know that there were some other conservatives that didn't like him too well, but he and I would always spar, but there was a level of respect, so I thought I was safe enough going in there. And as it was, I don't really feel like he gun-decked me. I just chose some very poor words.
Why did you recant your apology of some months ago with regard to those statements?
Well, that's what I've been quoted as saying is recanting it. Here's what happened. I said some words. They were intentionally misunderstood, blown out of proportion for political purposes, and then to the point to absurdity where the things people were saying were exactly opposite of what the actual words were. And so as a candidate, I had to deal with people's perception versus what I said. And we made the decision in the campaign that an apology, we could deal with their perception. And I didn't have enough money to try and explain it. And if I did, it was wasting money from the messages we need to do. So it was – the question is, do you apologize for what people think you said, which we decided to do? The downside of that, of course, is then it looks like you were guilty of something. Now, with the luxury of having a book, I can explain what the words were, where we were going. It wasn't that I said something wrong. It was just that what I said was misunderstood.
It sounds to me like what you're saying, it was politically expedient at the time to make that first apology.
Well, it was a political decision. It was a tactical question. It wasn't that there was nothing disingenuous about it. I was sorry that people were insulted or hurt to the degree they were. Some people were acting like they're hurt. I didn't think they were, probably. But anyway, if people were insulted or hurt by it, I was happy to say I was sorry, because certainly I didn't mean to do that, okay? So the apology was genuine enough. But my point is, though, that technically what I said was not technically wrong. It was just terrible choice of words.
Well, what's technically right about a woman's ability to shut down the birthing process?
The thing that was really kind of tragic about the comments was it was really a big parenthesis before the main point, and we never really got to the main point. The parenthesis was, if I were to put it in simple words, if a woman is raped, there's tremendous stress involved, and that can affect the probability of her becoming pregnant. Can a woman become pregnant from being raped? Well, for sure, because we had people that were children of rape working on our campaign. So I understood that, and I made that clear. I said that in the comment, whether it was clear or not, another question. So that was all I was saying, and that's what I'm saying is a parenthesis. And the real question is this, and that is, should the child who was conceived in rape have the same right to life as a child who's conceived in love? I mean, that's the heart of the hard pull. And Charles was taking it to me. That's the hardest question to ask somebody who's pro-life. And so that was the question. Should the child that's conceived in rape have the same right to life as the child that's conceived in love? And I was making the case, of course, yes, protecting life, which I think is more consistent logically, but is not statistically, politically the right answer.
Well, I think everybody is familiar with the firestorm that resulted from those comments. And some of your Republican friends were among the earliest to jump on it. You mentioned that you talked with the Huffington Post recently. I have a quote here. The Republican Party's worst nightmare is coming back to haunt it just as it hopes to win the Senate this fall. That nightmare, Congressman Aiken, would be Todd Aiken.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Certainly, maybe I should comment on that. I assume that was a question. Mm-hmm. First thing is, I don't have it in for Republicans. I campaigned all over this state. I think there are great Republicans all over the country and all over the state of Missouri. I'm thankful for the hard work they do for the party. They try to advance good government. And I have deepest respect for them. But I have been critical of some party bosses. And I think the question is it better not to tell the truth, not to tell anybody what happened and just kind of slink away? Or is it better for people to know what's going on, to understand what it's like to be in Congress, to understand what it's like to have the party turn against you? And I'm also critical of the Senate leadership, Karl Rove and others, in their approach to trying to win back the Senate. I think they're going about it all wrong. Now, I understand that makes some Republicans uncomfortable, but I think, in my opinion, when you tell the truth and you try to do it in love, I'm not trying to tar and feather anybody. I'm just simply saying I just don't agree with you. If we can't do that in America, and if we can't call out things that we think are wrong and give a plug for things that we think are good, then we're in a bad place as a country.
You say that some Republicans have turned against you. Do you think in any sense that you have turned against the party by coming out with this book at this time and raking over those old coals right before the election?
Well, and that's, I think, the same question you just asked. Mm-hmm. And my point is it turning against the party to just simply tell the truth and express an opinion about where we should be going? I don't think so. I don't think we ever advance good by running away from things that are not true or not good. I think we have to confront things around us that are not right and not good and be willing to take that responsibility. I think as Americans, sometimes we're so much want to be liked and so much don't want to get in any kind of conflict that we're afraid to say, wait a minute, that's stupid. That's bad. And I'm not agreeing with you, you know, and we need to do that in love. And I believe that was – and that was also goes to – your same question goes to the question of should you have quit partway down the line. Mm-hmm. It's the same basic line of reasoning.
And that's essentially what they were asking you to do.
Oh, they didn't ask me to do it. They demanded that I do it. When I didn't do it, they literally put it. I don't know if you've gotten to that chapter in the book. You ought to read it.
I've read the entire book, believe me.
It's pretty heavy-handed.
Well, I suppose from your point of view, that's certainly the case. I'm not sure as an outsider looking in would necessarily would think that way.
If you were one of my employees and the party called you and told you you have no future if you keep working for Aiken, that sounds heavy-handed to me.
All right. Let's move along to other things in the book. You, as indicated in the subtitle, you are concerned about your treatment by the so-called media elite. Define a media elite for me.
Well, there are some individuals that have a lot of influence over what particular things are chosen to report on. And those people have not, in my opinion, been fulfilling their trust to the American public, which is to give people some semblance of truth. Let me give you, I think that my own case is, in a way, a startling example of something that occurs every day. And there are many, many examples, but just because I was in the middle of it, I can give it as illustration. So I choose some words poorly. A number of people intentionally chose to misunderstand the words. Charles Jaco, who's very liberal, he knew what I was talking about. He says, well, let's go talk about economics. He knew what I'd said. And so regardless of whether you like the words or not or think they were tactless, or they were words. And Don, I think this is is pretty serious. They're words. Now, 2 weeks later, you have Bill Clinton, and if you put Broadrick's under sworn testimony claim that she was raped by Bill Clinton, and you set that aside, Bill Clinton still had a long history of sexual assault and sexual indecency with women. He is the keynote speaker at the Democrat convention and is cheered and applauded. Now, my question is, isn't there a difference between saying some words and either raping or sexually abusing a woman? There's a difference between the action and a word. And my question is, what's the effect on free speech? And what's the consistency of the media to give that an entire, just ignore the whole point? Then you spin forward, okay? And you go to the current administration's policy of encouraging and promoting abortions around the world. And in India and China, those abortions at times are used for sex selection. And it's for killing little girls. To me, that's a war on women. Who's got the war on women here anyway? And then go forward to Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton takes somebody she knows raped a 12-year-old girl. Now, it's not wrong to be an attorney for somebody, but she went further than that. Not only was she she was attorney for a guy she know raped this 12-year-old girl, but in the process of getting him off the hook, she undermined the credibility of this kid that was vulnerable and had just been raped. And if that's not going too far, then 10 years later, in retrospect, she does an interview and laughs about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. That's a war on women. That's a Democrat war on women. Where is the media on that one? Mm-hmm. And I could say that on a whole dozen other issues. For instance, the IRS attacking conservatives. Where was the media attention on that?
But, you know, if I may say so, Congressman, I get the impression in reading the book, and I read every word of it, that you've given me your definition of the media elite. But I got the impression that what you were talking about, the elite were those who didn't agree with you or who attacked you or not on your side.
Well, no, I think it's a fact that a great block of the media is not giving the truth to the American public, just telling them the truth by selecting things that they don't want to report on. They're hiding things to protect their own political agenda.
Is Fox News part of the media elite, for instance?
Well, I'm saying this is a trend, and you can look at individual reporters. Who's reported on Hillary Clinton and her laughing about getting a rapist off the hook? Who's raised the question?
I've certainly read that.
Yeah.
And I've heard that.
More by
so
blogs.
So somebody's well, whatever.
Yeah.
It's out there. I mean, the media is different today. It's a different animal than it was.
That's true. But who's talking about a Democrat war on women? Who's asking that question? See, this is an example.
I think Todd Aiken is. With your comments about Bill Clinton, for instance, I mean, I think you're saying you're on the other side of that.
Well, that's true. That's true. But I'm just saying I'm not hearing a consistent any kind of balance at all in terms of bringing some truth. And don't you think there's a difference between a word and an action?
Well, sure. I mean, that's something that we could certainly talk about, but let's move on to while we're on the subject of abortion, by the way, which you spent a lot of time talking about in your book, just as an aside, do you plan to lobby the Missouri legislature, and you have many friends down there soon, to override governor's veto of the 72-hour abortion bill he just vetoed?
My contacts in the state house are, 14 years old at this point, but I was always active on pro-life, but I was active on usually a broad spectrum of issues. Mm-hmm. If you really look at my time in Congress, it was not pro-life at all. It was all 12 years on Armed Services Committee, so it was national defense was a very big part. And the other, probably the most exciting committee I was on was the Budget Committee. So if you were to say, Todd, what do you think the biggest threat to America is today, right now? What do you think is most likely to totally disrupt our lives and cause all kinds of suffering in America? I'd say, I think it's spending $1 trillion a year we don't have. Mm.
Yeah. But you certainly do spend a lot of time on the abortion issue, which is fine. It's your book, but you do spend a lot of time.
Well, it's because that's where the thing started. That's where
I understand. Yeah. Back to the question, would you become involved in a decision to help override that veto?
If there were things I thought I could do to help it, I certainly would,
Mm-hmm. One more issue about the media elite. There was a comment by the former editor of the Wall Street Journal, which is basically a conservative publication, in which the editor said there is no such thing anymore because the media is so diverse. You mentioned blogs. It's certainly more diverse than that, that there is no single voice, certainly, in the media today.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Wall Street Journal. I believe Wall Street Journal has been off on their editorial page a bit. Not only Karl Rove's quotes, but a lot of other articles saying, and this is part of the reason for the book, they said, look, conservatives can't get elected to the Senate. Do you think so? Just look at Todd Akin. Well, my point on that is, well, okay, look at Todd Akin. He was a Reagan conservative in 88 when he ran, and he ran 24 years in elected office, reelected with great numbers, and was nothing more than a Reagan conservative. So what does that prove? And then the other question is, well, after the Republican Party attacked us and tried to dry up our money and made quotes that were used by the Democrats to kill us in the election, it's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it, to say, well, look, you can't elect this guy. And that jumps into then where we are in this election cycle, like in Mississippi, Don, where you have party bosses in the Senate that decide they're going to spend Republican money in a primary in Mississippi and other states to make sure they get the guy they think is right. And my belief is I believe in elections and not selections. So, and that came up
also in the book.
In the book, yeah.
We want to take some phone calls, but there's one other issue I want to raise because this is another impression I had in reading your book, and that is your use of the word patriot. You use it a lot in the book.
Right.
My sense, once again in reading it, was that it was a word that was reserved, as long as we're talking about words, a word that was reserved for people that supported you. And I wondered how you define patriot.
Well, no, it wasn't for people that supported me, although a great number of conservatives came to my assistance in the campaign. If they hadn't, the whole thing, our campaign would have just stopped dead, ran out of gas. Because Republicans, the top Republicans, tried to turn off the big donors from contributing. And so we got contributions from all over the country that people felt that I'd been unjustly attacked and was a good guy. So I would say a patriot, patriotism, if I were to give you a definition, would be it's a virtue. Patriotism's a virtue. It's it stands in the same relation between a man and his country as fidelity does between a man and his wife, and faith does between a man and his God. So patriotism is a virtue.
So it's not a word that you reserve only for the people who support you or who do heroic things. You pointed out an example of those who ran in and helped those at the World Trade Center were patriots.
Right.
As opposed to heroes.
I think, to me, the word patriot also implies that somebody is willing to give themselves to try to do good things for other people. And so that's why I'm using the word in that context. You think of the patriot forefathers, what were they doing? They're trying to leave a free country for their children. And so there's that element of self-sacrifice and love of country. And that, I think, is what you're seeing reflected.
I would be wrong, then, to suggest that those who don't support you are unpatriotic.
Not at all. You are wrong, and that's not what I meant.
Okay. Well, that's the sense that I had in reading it, but thank you for clarifying that. I'd like to take a couple of calls in time that remains, Todd Akin. Let's begin with Dan calling from St. Louis. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Mr. Akin, for your book and Serving Missouri, Telling the Truth and Fighting for Freedom in America. I really appreciate it. I just have an easy yes or no question for you. You can do that. Do you believe in the freedom for women having, or do you believe in women having the freedom to control their reproductive organs without politicians or the state making decisions for them?
Well, I think what you're trying to get at is, do you think there should be a law forbidding abortions? I think that's what you're trying to get at.
I think I'm trying to say is, do you believe in women being able to control the reproductive rights through, I don't know, taking a pill every day rather than, you know, somebody telling them they can't have sex or they're going to get pregnant?
Well, let me just make it clear. I don't have any, you know, if people want to use contraception, I don't have a problem with that personally at all. And the other question, though, is if you're getting at when it involves another person, that is a child, that's when I feel like then the child also has a right to life. So that's what makes me, quote, pro-life. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, and thank you for the call. Let's bring in Scott calling from Chesterfield. Scott, go ahead. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Go ahead.
About.com says that Plan B and Ella do not cause abortions. That's one thing. Also, I saw a study that by gynecologists that said that rape victims are more likely to get pregnant than women that have consensual sex. Could you comment on that?
Well, this is something that I'm not an OBGYN. There have been six recent studies saying that stress plays some effect on whether or not people conceive. The only thing I could suggest to you is perhaps you've heard anecdotally, I know of people who got married, they wanted to have children, they tried and tried 10 years. Finally, they adopt somebody, and 6 months later, boom, here, mom's pregnant. I would suggest that stress, many doctors feel that stress is a factor in people getting pregnant. I've never did I believe that that a woman who's raped can't get pregnant. Certainly they can. As I said, we had a number of people who were children of rape were working on our campaign. They understood that I was trying to protect the right to life of a child that's conceived in rape, just as I would protect the life of a child conceived in love.
Our time is starting to get away from us. There's one other issue I wanted to get, again, an explanation from you from the book, if I may, and that is your comments regarding pragmatism versus principle. The sense that I got from reading that is that you're basically saying that you stand by principle no matter what, and therefore compromise is basically out of the question.
Well, Don, I think you read a little more into the book than what I meant, and I tried to make it clear that a great deal of our lives, just day to day, we make little compromises with people. You hold the door, let them go first, or there's all sorts of ways that we defer to other people. So compromise isn't a bad thing inherently. But when compromise moves over to giving up a hard-held principle because you feel political pressure or you want to be cool or something, then compromise is a bad thing. So it's not always bad. It's what's bad is giving up truth and giving up what you think is good and right and true. That's what's bad. And that's and people say, well, I could never live in the political world because I tend to want to stand up for what's right. Well, you could do fine in the political world. I had a unique experience that it was 24 years in elected office, and sometimes party leadership would tell me, well, you ought to vote this, and this way, including a couple of phone calls from the president, which were the hardest vote in my life. But, you know, I found that if you do what you think is right in your own heart for your constituents and that you think is best for everybody, after the politics blows over, people think, there's a guy that isn't sold out. There's somebody who, I may not agree with him in this, that, or the thing, but he's not making deals and selling me down the river. Yeah. And I think a lot of people want someone that'll stand on principle, but that doesn't mean that you don't adjust that. You know, we're going to build some submarines. I think we should have 14. Well, you think we should have 12. Well, it's 13. Does that work? You know, that's we do that all the time in the political world.
Politics supposedly is the art of compromise. We don't see much of it these days in Washington. We're not seeing a whole lot of compromise. You'd agree with that.
Well, Don, you know what I think you're seeing? It's not that you're not seeing compromise. And I don't think the public understands this. You take the Republican Party. I'm doing this in person, which I can't do over the phone, over the microphone very well. But there is a chasm of difference between the Democrat Party and the Republican Party. They don't meet in the center like your liberal Republicans aren't like conservative Democrats. There's a big space in between. And so you've got two groups of people who have totally different views of where America should go and what the world is all about. And so it's very hard, for instance, like on abortion, how do you compromise? I think it's a kid. You shouldn't kill it. Well, so, I mean, how do you – so some of those positions are very hard to reconcile. And the people that I worked with in the political world, as much as they get beat up at times, there are some very, very fine, good people representing us. And in general, the congressmen I work with work very, very hard, try very hard to do the right thing, and live very, very busy schedules.
Our time is just about up. Very quickly, do you have a political future? Do you plan to run against Roy Blunt, for instance, who is not one of your most favorite persons, according to the book? Are you going to get back into the political game?
Well, first of all, now don't say that. I just spoke the truth as to what happened in the campaign. I don't really bear any animus to people. A long, long time ago, before I started in politics, I believed strongly in good ideas and bad ideas. I'm a salesman for good ideas, okay? I'm not somebody judging other people. I like getting along with everybody the best I can. So is there a future in politics? I don't know. Is it possible? Yeah, I've had 24 years experience in it. But it was an interesting thing to write a book. I don't know if anybody's going to read it or not, but it's been an interesting thing. And I've got some ideas for an invention because I am an engineer or something. So who knows? I think every day is an adventure, and we need to think of each other, try to make the world a better place.
Well, the Senate had appealed to you a couple of years ago. I'm just wondering if it might when Mr. Blunt is – Senator Blunt runs again.
Its appeal was strictly along a sense of duty rather than something that I thought would be all that fun.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Todd Akin, for being with us and taking our questions and taking our audience's questions. The new book is Firing Back, Taking on Party Bosses and Media Elite to Protect Our Faith and Our Freedom. Thank you so much for being with us,
Todd. It's a pleasure joining you, Don.
When we return, an update on that merger between the St. Louis Public Radio Organization and the St. Louis Beacon. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.